This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Bill C-11 addresses whether consumers can legally make copies of DVDs they own. And based on this government summary of the bill, the answer appears to be no. The summary says that the bill would legitimize things that Canadians do every day. For example, you can DVR a TV show to watch it later. You can copy music from your CDs to your MP3 player, but conspicuously missing from this list is making a copy of a DVD for your own personal use. And because you'd have to break a digital lock in order to do that, it appears that it would be illegal, and should a movie company decide to sue you for copyright infringement, you could be liable for up to $5,000. The no breaking digital locks and other provisions of Bill C-11 have incited public protests.
The question of copyright and digital locks, technically referred to as anti-circumvention measures, dates back more than 25 years with the creation of the World Intellectual Property Organization's Internet Treaties, and later in Canada with, as you just heard, what was then Bill C-11, the Copyright Modernization Act. Now, in the time since they were added to Canada's copyright regime, the full scope and application of those digital lock rules has been the subject of considerable debate, particularly over how fair dealing fits into the equation. The Federal Court of Canada recently issued a landmark decision on the issue, which concludes that digital lock should not trump fair dealing. Rather, the two must coexist in harmony, leading to an interpretation that users can still rely on fair dealing, even in cases involving digital locks. It was CIPIC, the University of Ottawa's Public Interest Technology Law Clinic, that intervened in the case and raised those arguments. James Plotkin, a partner with the law firm Gowlings, worked with David Feuer, CIPIC's director and general counsel, on the case. They both join me on the podcast to talk about the decision and to clear up some of the misinformation that has been circulating since its release. James and David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for joining. So as both of you know, because you were intimately involved, and I think a growing number of people are familiar, federal court recently released what I think is fair to say is one of the most consequential Canadian fair dealing and digital lock or anti-circumvention copyright rulings that we've seen in a long time. And what's really notable, especially for the purposes of our podcast today, is that they adopted arguments that were largely developed by you, as CIPIC was an intervener in the case. Now, as a caveat, I should note that I was closely involved in the creation of CIPIC, but had no involvement in this case. And so I'm anxious to get your insights, both in the process and the decision itself. I thought we should probably start with a bit of background. Not everybody knows Blacklocks, which is the news outlet that's at the heart of this case. But they're an Ottawa-based online news outlet, and they've been involved in a large number of copyright-related cases, typically involving the government. David, can you walk through a little bit some of the legal history here involving Blacklocks and copyright?
Yeah, I'll try to give a short version of what's becoming a pretty long history. Blacklocks has sued the Canadian government a number of times for copyright infringement, and all of these cases share a similar fact pattern. People within a government department or a Crown corporation become aware of a publication by Blacklocks. And then the article is shared amongst government employees. It's emailed around, or access might be enabled via a shared username or password. The cases have different facts. And the purpose of the sharing is what I describe as classic media monitoring purposes, right? To critically review the article, to assess it for accuracy, to see whether a response would be required. And then after the passage of some time, Blacklocks files an access to information request to find evidence of those articles being shared by the department. And finding such evidence, they then later sue, alleging that that the sharing constitutes copyright infringement. In some cases, they also allege that sharing content that's only available via subscription behind a paywall constitutes circumvention of a digital lock, circumvention of that paywall. The first of the cases came to court in 2016, the Department of Finance case, and there Justice Barnes dismissed the claim, finding that the use of the copyright materials was obviously for fair dealing purposes. Now, in that case, Blacklocks didn't plead circumvention in the statement of claim, so the matter was just kind of restricted to classic fair dealing analysis, infringement and fair dealing. And the case didn't really involve a shared password. It was just an article shared around by email by people who needed to respond. And because every fair dealing decision turns on its facts, the case didn't prove to be much of a test case or precedent. Although, as we'll see in this case, it did prove incredibly influential to this decision and its fair dealing analysis.
Okay, so yeah, so that finance case involved, I think it was at least a couple of articles sent externally into the department. They get shared in the department, as you suggest. That sounds a lot like fair dealing. And that's exactly what the court found.
Yeah, it had no difficulty.
Yeah, which becomes, as you suggest, relevant in this case, because James, they lost that particular case, but this one's slightly different because it involved, rather than having an external third-party subscriber who'd sent articles into the department, this one has somewhat different facts involving, I believe, Parks Canada. Maybe you can tell us a bit about the facts of this particular case.
Sure. Yeah, this case was a little bit different. So in a nutshell, a Parks Canada employee, someone in their media relations department, purchased an individual subscription from Black Box. She accessed a number of articles specifically related to Parks Canada's mandate and operations. And the uncontested evidence was that employees within Parks Canada would receive emails from Black Locks journalists or reporters referring to content that was, quote, and this is from the decision, either deceitful or misleading or alarmist. And so she purchased a subscription on the instructions of one of her superiors, and she indicated that there was like one subscription option available on the website, and an individual subscription. This evidence was contested. And she ultimately said that she received an email confirmation that after selecting the only subscription option on the website, she received an email saying that, quote, institutional subscribers should contact a certain person at Black Box for bulk rates. That term was a bit of a mystery to her. At least that was her evidence. She didn't understand what bulk rates meant. She thought, you know, I've got my subscription, so I guess we're good to go. Now, it's important to note, I think, Michael, that the evidence was less than clear here, specifically as to what the checkout page said. And the judge, Justice Hua, refused to accept some of the evidence from Black Box as hearsay. And Black Box did have some difficulty proving its case on this point, on basically what the terms were and what the website checkout page actually said. And in the end, the court accepted Parks Canada's evidence that the employee who signed up for the purchase, she did select, in fact, the only subscription option available to her. And again, ultimately, Blacklock submitted that access to information request, similarly to how David said in the previous cases, to identify which articles were shared and with whom, and then they sued for copyright infringement on that basis.
Okay, that's a great summary. So, David, before we get to sort of what the judge has to say and the legal arguments that arose in this case, how does CIPIC find its way into this case, and how does the court view CIPIC's involvement in this case? Because I think it seems to me it was pretty notable.
Well, I'll give some of the, I guess, the factual background, and then talk a little bit about CIPIC and the intervention. First, I should point out that James is a former student of mine at the university here. He worked with me at the clinic on these issues, on anti-circumvention law and the modifications to Canada's Copyright Act that came in at the same time. So we've got a long history of doing this stuff. And since he's gone into practice, he's worked with CIPIC on a number of times on a pro bono basis in some pretty significant interventions. James was watching this case, and he saw the opportunity to intervene with an argument about the interpretation of digital locks provisions that was very consistent with CIPIC's historical view and concerns around this legislation. And he came to me with the opportunity. It suggested that this would be a good place for CIPIC to intervene, and we jumped at the chance. Now, our motion to intervene was very well received. An intervention order, in fact, recognized our long experience as public interest interveners and our expertise in copyright matters, and recognized that we've been helpful interveners at all levels of federal court and in the Supreme Court. So it's always gratifying to see that in a intervention order. And our intervention itself was also extremely well received. And I'll say it's always gratifying when a court recognizes our contribution. And here the court complimented us, saying that we delivered exactly what we said we were going to do, and it was pleased with the quality of the submissions. And particularly in interpreting the anti-circumvention provisions, the court relied heavily on our argument.
Yeah, and that's great. And I want to come obviously to that, and I'm hoping James can take us through that. But before we do that, quickly, David, the fair dealing side, and you hinted earlier on that there was some influence from the earlier finance case. Can you talk about what the court has to say with respect to the fair dealing side of this case?
Yeah. So just on the classic copyright infringement analysis, the court pretty clearly found that this was a fair dealing. It didn't have much difficulty pushing aside allegations that this was copyright infringement. And it did rely pretty heavily on the finance case. The court basically went through the finance decision and almost mimicked paragraph by paragraph the same kind of finding. So, you know, we've given you the facts of this situation. The court identified that, the BlackLocks wasn't hacked or accessed by any kind of illicit means. A subscription had been purchased, and the subscription was what was used to access the content. The content was used for a legitimate business purpose. The court recognized that this kind of classic media monitoring activity is core, is core fair dealing activity. It was valid. It was limited to that valid purpose. The circulation of articles was limited to people who had a need to know. There was no commercial advantage gained. The concerns around misleading statements and the alarmist nature of some of the articles that were shared was a reasonable basis for concern. Interestingly, I think we're going to get into this in a bit, the terms and conditions themselves that BlackLocks purported to impose on users were not ignored, but they were not known. And in any event, they were ambiguous and didn't restrict kind of the personal or non-commercial purposes that media monitoring involves. From my perspective, I was gratified that the court picked up on the fact that this is all about reading, right? That media monitoring, what Parks Canada officials were doing was the simple act of reading. That's what the decision says. And this is the very purpose of the balance that includes fair dealing. And then finally, the court picking up on the public interest angle here said that there is a legitimate public interest, a significant public interest in reading articles with a view to protecting the public and the press against errors and omissions. And on that basis, the court dismissed fairly out of hand any claim that this was not fair dealing.
Okay, so a strong fair dealing decision, consistent with what we've seen in Canadian case law for some time, but it's always nice to see it affirmed. What makes this case really interesting and notable, though, I think, is the anti-circumvention side of the story. James, it may help to explain a little bit anti-circumvention law just to ensure everybody understands it, but then even more, if we can talk a bit about how the court grapples with that particular issue, because that's really, as I say, what makes this case particularly notable.
Sure. And David alluded to this a little bit earlier in my research as a dutiful CIPIC intern back in, it was 2010, 2011, when this was all winding its way through Parliament. And you, Michael, were in front of the committees explaining why things should be the way they are, and others maybe telling the committees other things. But so when the Copyright Modernization Act, Bill C-11, went through, there were a number of stakeholder interests, and two of the big amendments that came in were a modification to the fair dealing provision itself to add education, parody, and satire as fair dealing categories. And another big piece was these anti-circumvention provisions that were added to the remedy section of the Act, Part 4 of the Act. And the anti-circumvention provisions, there are two types. There are copy controls and access controls, and the term circumvention is defined. And effectively, the Act grants copyright owners all of the remedies that they can obtain for copyright infringement, also for the circumvention of a TPM, at least we said, when there's an infringement of copyright. So the way we put it in our factum is an additional remedial arrow in the rights holder's quiver when it comes to enforcing copyright on the internet. And that comes from the legislative history. And so those provisions were front and center here because, you know, as you alluded to earlier, and a distinction from the finance case is that BlackLocks argue that in addition to infringement, there's the circumvention of the TPM by the sharing of the password, that the Parks Canada employee, in sharing the password, circumvented a TPM within the meaning of the act. And so Blacklock's first tried to argue that the password at issue, which is a pretty standard alphanumeric password, is a, quote, effective TPM. Again, that's language from the statute. And that circumventing it precluded fair dealing. In other words, you're not dealing fairly with the work if you circumvent a TPM to access it and do whatever it is you want to do, read it, you know, use it, mash it up or otherwise. And the court rejected this argument. It started by noting on a more of a technical level that just a total lack of expert evidence, which prevented it from making findings of fact as to whether the password system in effect here was actually, quote, an effective TPM, because that is a prerequisite to accessing the TPM provisions. CIPIC didn't say too much about that because, again, our role was not to address the facts of this case in particular, but really more the statutory interpretation piece. And the upshot of the court's reasoning, at least as I read it, is that the TPM provisions do not, as a matter of law, restrain fair dealing. The court did note that, you know, the manner in which a password is obtained may prevent a user from invoking fair dealing. You know, in other words, it's part of the character of the dealing, it's part of the fair dealing analysis, which is, I think, a very fair conclusion. And, you know, to give listeners a very stark offline example, you know, if I take a brick and put it through a plate glass window of a bookstore and grab a book and use it to copy, well, that's extremely unlikely to be considered fair dealing because the manner in which I acquired the work is, you know, illegal. So, you know, the fairness or the character of the dealing will lie on a spectrum. Again, that's a particularly stark example, but the court did leave room for the possibility that circumvention can play into the fairness analysis and effectively, on the facts of a given case, render a dealing not fair. But as a matter of law, the TPM provisions do not restrain fair dealing. And this is a critical piece of CIPIC's argument, because we were saying that, look, if you're engaging in fair dealing, you're not infringing copyright. And to the extent that the TPM provisions are a remedial tool for copyright owners to restrain infringement and police their copyright, well, if you're not infringing copyright, then the mischief that the TPM provisions were there to remediate is just not in play. And the court, I think, broadly accepted that argument. In fact, my favorite part of the reasons is where Justice Hua says that our submission answered the, quote, elephant in the room, which is what are the TPM provisions purpose? And we effectively said, you know, what I said earlier, you know, it's about enhancing digital copyright enforcement online. But once again, if you're not infringing, you just never get out of the gate.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, this issue of whether or not, or what role fair dealing played within the anti-circumvention rules was a hotly contested issue more than 10 years ago, back when this legislation was being created. You know, was it both of your thoughts that it's been there all the time? Because certainly some of the debate has been you need a specific carve out for fair dealing as part of the anti-circumvention rules. You know, what I'm hearing here is that the court is essentially saying it's always been there, and that in fact, you know, what's central to the application of these anti-circumvention rules, these digital lock rules, is that if you're not infringing, and one reason that you may be able to cite for not infringing is fair dealing, then that applies as part of that analysis.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And one of the arguments that Blacklock's made was, well, look, you have all these specific exceptions to the TPM provisions, all of these, you know, narrow allowable purposes to circumvent the TPM that are baked into the TPM remedy provision in the Act. And our response to that is, well, twofold. First of all, the Supreme Court in CCH is quite clear that fair dealing is, quote, always available, even in the face of a more specific exception. In that case, it was the library exemption that was at issue. In that case, it was about, you know, copying in libraries. But, you know, so the court accepted that reasoning. And also, just from a textual level, the TPM provision says that subject to this act, such and such remedies are available. And we said, well, the subject to this act surely means those exceptions to infringement and defenses to infringement that are part of the legislative scheme, including fair dealing.
The TPM provisions are in the remedy section, right? Like they're in that half of the legislation. And, you know, the court, you know, very clearly says, you know, if it was Parliament's intent to capture lawful dealings under circumvention, then it would be very explicit in doing so. And I always thought about the, like you know, what are the real test cases, right? Like the real clear cases where the anti-circumvention provisions could be misused by a bad actor to stifle what's clearly public interest communications. Like I'm thinking about like a whistleblower taking encrypted documents out of bad circumstances, out of a bad corporation or criminal enterprise. Are we really saying that those encrypted documents can't be broken and disclosed to the public? Is that what the Copyright Act is supposed to be doing? Plainly not. And yet there's no explicit exception in the anti-circumvention provisions to deal with these kinds of very plainly, clearly public interest oriented dealings. Similarly, newscasting and news reporting. Are we actually saying that you can't take a clip off of a DVD, and use that in the news because a DVD, includes some encryption and content scrambling technology? Plainly, that can't be the case. We would be looking for much clearer language from Parliament if that was the intent, and that language isn't there. So that takes us to James's analysis. Well, how does this fit into the Act? How do we actually interpret this provision in a manner that's consistent with the whole scheme of the Act as a whole? And that was the argument that we put to the court. And the court accepted.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a really well-crafted argument that does a nice job of weaving in both the legislative history and, in a sense, almost common sense, sort of some of the use cases that might arise, so to speak. The case has attracted quite a lot of attention. I think it's been the target of fair amount of misinformation as well. And I thought one of the things that would be useful here would be to set the record straight a little bit. Let's start with the one that I see, sort of at least on social media, circulating quite a bit. This notion that somehow the upshot of this decision is that anybody can share any password for any service. Is that what the court is saying with this decision? James.
No, that's explicitly not what the court is saying. And I'm a little bit surprised every time I read that. And you're right, there's quite a bit of that going around. One of the points that SIPC actually made to support our statutory interpretation was, look, these provisions needn't actually cover the field. Fair dealing is a defense an ability to defend a claim for copyright infringement. It's not a defense to breach of contract. So to the extent that, Blacklocks or any other content owner wishes to police access to their work via contract, fair dealing really has nothing to say about that. So, the way we put it in our factum, there's no wrong crying out for a remedy here. This is just simply the way that the case was brought and in our view was perhaps it was a bit of a square peg round hole situation given the attempt to hamstring fair dealing by way of a remedial provision that presupposes copyright infringement. So no, in my view, the decision in no way suggests that, it's free for all password sharing. There's no such thing as contracts anymore. Paywalls are a thing of the past. That's certainly a bunch of fear mongering that has no basis in the reasons.
Okay. Dave?
Yeah, I'll just chime in that I mean, the court is so clear here that the use of the password was as intended, that it was a licit use of the password. And the other piece that's really important here is that the court very explicitly weaves this into its fair dealing analysis, and it says that use of a password, in a hacking case, for example, that might go to the fairness of the dealing. And so that gets you into the anti-circumvention remedies because you don't have a fair dealing in those circumstances. So, the nature of the use of the password is crucial, I think, on both sides of this decision.
Okay, you mentioned the terms and conditions and the contractual elements here. Let's pick up a little bit on that. I will note there is still some debate for some people about whether or not contract can be used to simply remove all fair dealing rights. But we'll park that to the side for a moment because certainly some of the debate that has arisen also raises this notion that somehow the terms were clear. I've seen some post this online. The terms were clear, and so basically, doesn't matter what your contract says, people have the ability to engage in password sharing and the like. What did the court actually find on that point?
I'll jump in first on this. So it's important to to look at the actual analysis that the court undertook here. This is not a case of clear terms and conditions that, you know, the finance or Parks Canada ought to have been aware of, that it was one user, one password, one use kind of thing. Instead, the court actually adopted the same kind of analysis as the Department of Finance court did. I think it was the same basic terms and conditions in front of them, where they pointed to kind of what I describe as some kind of anomalous behavior in even on the contract formation side. So like there was no user checkbox, for example, you know, that I agree to these terms and conditions. It was just kind of an, you know, a hyperlink at the bottom of the page and not very particular or conspicuous. And the terms themselves, the court concluded, were ambiguous. It didn't unambiguously restrict the kind of activity that, that BlackRock's was complaining about here. You know, the court read the terms as allowing for personal uses and also non-commercial uses. And then further on, it notes that the terms and conditions themselves speak to content being made available for non-commercial, personal, or educational purposes only. And the court effectively said that there's a pretty good argument here that that's exactly how this content was being used consistently with the terms and conditions, but regardless, that there is insufficient clarity to support BlackRock's argument as to the effect of the terms and conditions. In a different case, better contractual formation, better terms and conditions, maybe you get a different outcome.
One more that I wanted to touch on, and I don't know how closely involved either of you are on some of the trade-related obligations, but I have also seen some seek to suggest that this interpretation, I take the comment to be, this interpretation of any circumvention may run afoul of Canada's trade obligations. And that, of course, arises first out of the WIPO internet treaties, and then more particularly obligations that would come from our trade agreements with the United States and Mexico. Have you have any thoughts? And this, I guess, in some ways comes back to, James, some of your initial thinking on the anti-circumvention rules and how they get implemented on some of those claims that somehow now this decision puts Canada offside some of those obligations.
Yeah, you know, I've heard whispers, you know, some people suggesting that this puts Canada offside of CUSMA. I haven't done that analysis myself, so I don't think I'll speak to that today. I mean, as far as the WIPO internet treaties are concerned, I don't, and this was part of our submission, it's entirely consistent with those treaties to give effect to users' rights like fair dealing. So we certainly didn't read those obligations as in any way requiring the TPM provisions to effectively neuter fair dealing in a digital environment. I mean, that's, I don't think something that would withstand scrutiny based on the way the Supreme Court has interpreted the careful balance between user and owner's rights, and absent irresistibly clear language in the legislation, which again, as we argued, is certainly far from there, and in fact, you know, points in the other direction.
Yeah, I'd echo that on the WIPO treaties. I mean, the kind of a cornerstone of the implementation or the interpretation of the WIPO treaties has been kind of flexibility. You know, the Supreme Court itself has been pretty clear, you know, on that approach and in interpreting different aspects of WIPO that have been subsequently implemented in Canadian copyright law. And so the claim that this, you know, violates WIPO, I just don't think that holds any water. The CUSMA claim is a little bit more interesting because the language in CUSMA, I think, is clearer. But, you know, well, even on the most what I would describe as the sharpest, even the sharpest interpretation of CUSMA, it's not a self-executing trade agreement, right? It's not law. Canada has to implement those obligations. And even if you agreed with the argument that we're offside CUSMA, that just leaves our trade partners with remedies under that under that trade agreement. It's not that. It's not that the laws are void or of no force and effect because they're inconsistent with the statute. And we've got the other problem that if we do interpret the anti-circumvention provisions as outlawing the kinds of clear public interest dealings with content that I talked about earlier, you know, the whistleblower cases and the newscaster cases, these kinds of things, then we very plainly do have some constitutional issues with this legislation. And the court acknowledged that, at least dipped its hat to that claim in the provision, because the court said that its interpretation of the anti-circumvention provisions avoided the need to undertake any kind of constitutional analysis. A different, you know, and then the suggestion obviously is that a different interpretation, one a little bit closer to what Blacklock's and some out there in the media might be pushing, raises that question.
Okay, that's a really helpful analysis, and I like that you've woven in the question of the public interest and its role here, because it's literally in the name of CIPIC, Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic. And so I want to thank you both for joining me on the podcast, but even more for the work that you've done, because I think in many respects it is exactly what a technology law clinic focused on the public interest is all about, and ensuring that public interest but for your intervention might not have made its way into arguments before the court and then ultimately into the decision. Huge contribution, I think, to our understanding of copyright in Canada and how that copyright balance applies, not just in the analog world, but now also in the digital world as well.
Thank you very much, Michael. And thank you, James, for your efforts on our behalf here.
Thanks to you both. It was great fun.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.